Snoring can disrupt marriages and cause serious health problems. Call Sleep Better Northwest first, the experts in dental sleep medicine. Their medically approved, custom-fit oral appliances will have both you and your partner sleeping better and being more productive throughout your day. Don't wait. Snoring and sleep apnea can signal potential strokes or heart attacks. For more information, visit needbettersleepnow.com and download our health guide today. Sleep Better Northwest, the experts in dental sleep medicine.
Welcome to Let's Talk Spokane, where host Ryan McNeese seeks out and discusses the latest on a variety of hot local topics. Now, here's your host, Ryan McNeese.
Welcome back to the program. This is Let's Talk Spokane. I'm Ryan McNeese, and I am honored today to have Colonel Robert Esty, Rob Esty, here with us in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Ryan. This is great.
You know, we've been trying to get you on the show for a while and trying to make your schedule work. You're a busy guy flying around the country with Full Sail Ale. It's a tough job drinking beer for a living.
That's only half the job. You got to sell some of it, too.
Well, I jest. You know, we're excited to have you on the show. You know, the point of this show is really to find interesting stories that are going on in our area. And I think you go, quite frankly, to the top of the list. You're a West Valley grad, West Point, Army career, colonel, currently retired, now working for Full Sail Ale. Let's go all the way back to the beginning, though. I mean, to try to have this conversation a half hour is almost impossible. But you leave West Valley playing all sports, obviously doing very well in school to make your way to West Point. What was that West Point experience like?
Well, you come out of high school pretty well-rounded if you're a mm-hmm. son of a public schools administrator. My dad,
true.
My mom was a school board president in West Valley. Had great example, brothers and sisters, cousins, family members and friends in West Valley that show you how to do it.
Right.
So you come out of there well set for what West Point was going to throw at me.
Which would be a lot. I mean, that's not taken off to your normal four-year university. I mean, you know what you're in for going to West Point, probably. Or
yeah,
you might think you do.
Yeah, you might think so, but the day you get there, you have a shock in front of you. And even if you're from a military family, which I wasn't,
right.
you're going to get a wake-up call on day one. But West Point is a regular college program. It's a four-year hardcore broad liberal arts education.
In your case, also engineering, I believe.
Yeah, and you pick a major. I picked mechanical engineering and came out of there with a Bachelor of Science in mechanical systems engineering. But you know, as you go through all this education, and it's rigorous, it's 20 credit hours a semester. It's hardcore. We went to class for half of Saturdays most weeks, the first half of that.
Well, we're training our officers.
Yeah, I mean, you need to know a lot about how the world works when you get out into the world as an Army officer, and West Point puts it in there. We used to say it was $250,000 education jammed down our throats one nickel at a time.
That's probably a good way to say it.
We didn't say it that way. It got jammed somewhere, but as you go through, you learn not only all the academics, but you learn a lot about how to lead. You're put into leadership positions and in trying situations, and you are forced to learn how to lead.
And so when you come out of a four-year education at West Point, obviously as acclaimed as any university in the country, what's the first step? When someone graduates from West Point, we'll chat about this a bit, but you're also an Army Ranger and the rigorous nature of that training. But what's step one when you come out of West Point? How do you decide what your first commission, if you will, is going to be?
So about midway, or early, the first third of your senior year, you find out what branch of the Army you're going to serve in. In fact, I think they just found out last week what branches they're all going to serve in either infantry, armor, artillery, engineers, aviation, and on and on.
Is there a little bit of choice in that, or is it more of a they identify the skills they see?
No, you get to put in your preference, mm-hmm. and then based on your class rank, you get what you prefer.
Right.
I was
a little bit of seniority in regards to grades.
Yeah, grades and military grades, basically, and physical mm-hmm. performance. So all those things go into your class rank, and that's how you get to pick what you are going to be. Now, I was fairly well down the order of merit list, and of course, what I wanted to be, there was a lot of slots for in the Army, and that was infantry officers. I thought that coming out of West Point, I wanted to lead in the hardest, most austere, most extreme environment I could, and see where it took me. So,
and it did take you in a lot of places.
Yeah, so you come out of West Point, and then you move off to your branch schools, and infantry was at Fort Benning, Georgia. And they run you through about a nine-month program where you learn how to be a infantry platoon leader, an infantry officer. As well, I went to Ranger School, which is another couple months of...
Okay, so chronologically, you did do infantry, the nine-month school, and then Ranger School after that?
Yeah. And I did a winter Ranger School, November, December. It's cold, it's miserable, you don't eat much, you don't sleep much, you lead people in extreme,
I'll tell you, you
hard are, times.
Well, again, yet again, honing your skills as an officer in these important, critical situations for our country. You should write a book about Ranger School alone, let alone the many different stories that that you've had.
Well,
now where does Airborne come into that in the chronology of your life experiences?
So if you haven't been trained how to jump out of planes by the time you get to
which I have not, by
infantry
the way.
School or Ranger School, you get fed through that school on the way. That's a shorter course, I think 3 to 5 weeks what it is now. But one of the summer programs I did at West Point, when you know the academic year is out, you do summertime training where you'll go gain a skill like parachuting, military parachuting, or air assault, where you slide down ropes out of helicopters, or northern warfare.
And I think the obvious when you say military parachuting, obviously a lot closer to the ground than you ordinarily would be.
Yeah, when you at the time we were jumping in training at 800 feet, and now I think we're up to 1,000 feet.
What would be a standard if you were to go out to Ritzville and do a recreational jump? What type of altitude are they at?
If you're doing a recreational, I've only done a couple, mm-hmm. but we jump. The first one I think was 3,000 feet. I did a tandem jump out in outside of Tacoma at Kapowskin Airfield way back in the late 80s, where we jumped out, I think, at 20,000. And
holy cow.
It was tandem, so I was attached to another.
So versus 1,000.
Yeah, 1,000.
That's significant. Yeah.
And then one of my first assignments at Fort Lewis, I got into the 2nd Ranger Battalion, and the first mission I was on with them was the combat parachute assault into Panama.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, because that was significant. My understanding is this is one of the first airborne jumps into live combat.
It was one of the few. There's been plenty. World War II, as you know, the Saving Private Ryan, the Band of Brothers jumps on Normandy, and the various other jumps over time. But we hadn't done one as an American Army for quite some time. And we did one in Grenada, I think that was in 83. And then here it was, December 89, and we're called to parachute in. It's a forced entry. It's the way we gain a foothold into a foreign country. Or one of the ways, and you use your Rangers and your airborne forces, and you seize airfields or beachheads or however you're going to do it, using these guys. And so you come out of West Valley, West Point, infantry, Ranger, all of a sudden you're a leader of an organization in a combat situation, and it's
exciting. Jumping out of airplanes into live fire.
Yeah.
That'll wake you up.
Yeah, they told me the next day 10 out of the 13 planes in my flight were not able to fly because they had holes in them the next morning. We flew over at about 500 feet, and exited the aircraft, and at that altitude, if your parachute doesn't open, you don't have time for a reserve. So but it keeps the enemies from zeroing in on you.
Right, they don't have time, and nor do you.
And hurting you in the plane.
Neither side has a lot of time to think about it. So that's in 1989, so obviously significant experience there. As you crest into the early 90s, what were you doing at that stage in the military?
So after 4 years in Tacoma at Fort Lewis as a motorized, two years as motorized on Humvees, then 2 years in the Rangers as an airborne ranger, I went to another school. I mean, the Army sends you to school to teach you what you need to know on your next tour.
Keep you up to speed on skills.
I went to learn how to lead Bradley Infantry Fighting Vehicle Forces, and so they taught me how to be a company commander and a Bradley Infantry Fighting Vehicle commander. So, and then I went to Korea to command a rifle company, Bradley's tanks, over in Camp Casey, Korea, which again is where I wanted to be, on the front edge.
What year would that have been?
That was 92-93. Okay. I was over there for about a year. Commanded a company, the first of three that I ended up commanding over the next few years. But it was a really incredible company. I had 13 or 14 Bradleys, and when it came time to get ready to fight, you would trade a Bradley platoon for a tank platoon, so I might end up with four tanks. And you're over in Korea with 120 U.S. soldiers and
living on a specific base.
Living on.
And Korea's all around you.
Camp Casey. And
real world.
Yeah, it's the world. You're within range of the North Korean artillery.
And at what point did you reach captain status? Obviously retired as a colonel, but at what point did you reach captain status?
Right, so as I left the Rangers, I got promoted to captain.
Okay.
Yeah, so you command companies as a captain and you're a staff officer through those years. So I left Korea for a year. After that, I went to Fort Irwin, California, down in the Mojave Desert, teaching mounted forces how to fight in the high desert. Did that a couple years and saw an opportunity in Arlington, Virginia, where another rifle company was open. And I went and commanded Charlie Company of the Old Guard, which does funerals and
That's
ceremonies.
Amazing. To have Arlington. That experience at Arlington. And if anybody hasn't had the opportunity to do Arlington, you certainly should, right? It's phenomenal.
It's a national treasure, and it's as sacred a ground as any in the country.
Just the visual alone, when I first saw it, it's just inspiring. Rob, let's come right back after a short little break, and there's plenty more to chat about. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Love talking with you.
Congratulations. You found where Spokane Talks online. Tell your friends.
If you know what amortization, bridge loans, and HELOCs are, well, you're pretty smart. The financial world is brimming with acronyms and other confusing terms, which can make it harder to make decisions about spending, saving, and borrowing money. If you could use an introduction, go to STCU's financial education blog at stcumoney.org. You'll find out whether you've been amortizing all along, and the experts at the credit union will translate some of the other important financial concepts too.
A special thank you to our friends at Tom Sawyer Country Coffee, the official coffee supplier here at Spokane Talks Online.
The stories and photos on the pages of Nostalgia Magazine show glimpses of life in the Inland Northwest from years gone by. From home life, school days, and the workplace, you can relive a style of life that we all loved and cherished. Call today to subscribe, 443-3678. Or visit us online at nostalgiamagazine.net. Nostalgia Magazine. Ageless stories, ageless photos.
Welcome back. I am McNeese, and I'm here with Colonel Rob Estee. Thanks, Rob. Appreciate you being with us today.
I love coming down.
Well, I think we said at the beginning of the show, this is one of those shows I think we could go on for episode 1, 2, 3, and 4, probably, because there's so many fascinating chapters of your experience in the military and beyond. But right before the break, we were chatting about your opportunity to be at Arlington and how amazing that experience would be. After Arlington, what was your next stop in the Army?
Well, I left Virginia, went to Kansas for a year of school. Again, the Army teaches you what you need to
know. Yeah, and what was the school in Kansas?
It was the Command and General Staff Officers course. And they teach you how to be a major and advance into the organizational level of leadership. So a year of that, advanced schooling. It's all in uniform. It's at an incredible school, one of the most incredible libraries in the world out there. And we just beat our majors up and teach them how to plan and how to lead organizations. So,
well, I think an interesting part of this discussion today has been the significant schooling at each stage. I mean, obviously West Point, that goes without saying, very rigorous. But you've definitely hit upon several of the different units that you're involved in that they drill down to a massive degree in these given areas to train you up for the next mission, if you will. And this one sounds on its surface like a fun mission, but I think after that you ended up at Pearl Harbor, didn't you?
I moved out from Leavenworth. I went to Fort Bragg for a few years as a leader of airborne forces, again, in the 82nd Airborne Division.
Okay.
I was the operations officer in an airborne unit and then the executive officer, so from the number three and the number two man in an airborne battalion. And then after that time, we had an assignment in Hawaii. I got married at the beginning of that tour.
Okay, so before you went to Pearl Harbor, you were married, and you're married now?
Yep. As we went to Fort Bragg, we got married. My wife is awesome. We got married in 2000. We have two children. Now they're 14 and 12-year-old kids. Great.
Time flies.
Awesome kids. I moved back to Spokane to raise them the way I was raised.
So at least one of the kids was born in Hawaii, right?
Yeah, two of them, both.
They both were.
Yeah, Tripler Army Medical Center over there. We did a joint tour over there where you work with the other armed forces. I was a exercise planner on the Pacific Command staff.
Well, my understanding there was, I think as you're describing, you would go out for several weeks at a time on the battleships, right? Or on the carriers.
A couple of times I went on the command ship of the 7th Fleet, once on the USS Blue Ridge, and then the other time that their command ship was in for some work, so we borrowed another fleet's command ship, the USS Coronado. So I was out two different occasions for a few weeks, planning, leading, running an exercise for the 7th Fleet.
It's certainly interesting. I think as we have the annual celebration of the Pearl Harbor Memorial and the events, December 7th, 1941, that's coming up here pretty quick. How long were you guys in Pearl Harbor total?
We were at in Hawaii for a couple of years.
Two
years or so. And then I got picked to command a battalion.
Well, I was going to say, unfortunately, the Iraq war was moving forward at that point in time. And with all your experience and training, you were probably one of the top on the list to send you there to command.
Well, I was one of many very well-qualified people, and it was my great fortune the Army picked me to command a battalion. I showed up to take over and looked around and asked my boss where it was, and they said, you're it. We built it. There was no battalion. We built it from scratch, from one guy, me, all the way up to about 900 when we deployed.
And were you residing in the green zone with your battalion?
Yeah, when we got to Iraq, we had the Central Baghdad mission, and we had a forward operating base inside the green zone. So I secured the green zone, the international zone, the newly formed Iraq government, and I also had responsibility for a lot of Central Baghdad.
Remind me the thoroughfare, though, and the name, where you oftentimes would go out, come back, out, come back, but one of the most dangerous thoroughfares.
Yeah, we called it Route Irish. It was a highway that went from the Baghdad International Airport up to the capital up in Baghdad's central. And I had an engineer platoon that sent a couple patrols out every day 6 days a week for the whole year. And we would clear roads. We'd pick up IEDs and clear bombs off the roads and make them safe for travel.
That's sad.
But I would go out and meet local leaders and use all the routes around town to get to and from their headquarters.
You know, that experience alone and all the different aspects we've been talking about today, what you were able to observe, perceive, be a part of, really is fascinating. The world leaders that you were working with on the ground in this dangerous zone in Iraq, it's fascinating. It really is. And the negotiations that were occurring and how those negotiations actually occur. I mean, these folks don't necessarily speak the same language. I know we've discussed some stories where some real tense times. Matter of fact, I think there's one story that's coming to mind to me right now that you were in a room with several diverse world leaders and the lights went off. Darkness in the room.
And that was almost, electricity in Baghdad was a scarce resource, and it would come on and go off regularly, and we'd be in meetings with 20 or 30 key leaders, and the power goes out, and nobody even stops speaking. They just keep on doing what you're doing.
That's like a regular occurrence.
Yeah, it's just part of the game.
And well, I certainly remember that story, because didn't the lights come back on, and everybody's still sitting there, and nobody got up? And
yeah, we just keep right on talking. Keep on, you know, you're drinking little cups of tea with them, and you're negotiating how you're going to arrange security or an event in the city.
The negotiations just keep going.
You just keep right on talking.
What was the year that you left Iraq?
Well, I left in December of 2006.
2006, okay.
So we had a very stable Iraq probably the first half of that year, and then the mosque up in Samarra was blown up, and it turned that whole country into a big ant pile again. So we spent the rest of the year slugging it out, separating forces and trying to impose some form of security on that country.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed over the years understanding and hearing your perspective, because anybody that doesn't think that that's a complex, very complex issue, whether it be Iraq or other countries that we're dealing with right now in the Middle East. It's a very complex issue, and obviously appreciate your incredible service for day in and day out, trying to move it forward on a day-to-day basis. And probably what is difficult at times is moving it forward two steps, back three, or forward four, but a constant battle.
You just go over there and do your best every day. You try to make difficult things, break them into simple tasks, and just do them one at a time.
And accomplish your mission by mission. Yep. At what year did you decide to retire?
So I was overseas, and I hit my 20-year mark, and I was reading bedtime stories to my 4 and 2-year-old children through Skype, and I thought to myself, this has got to stop. Yeah. I need to be involved personally with my family. Right. So that's when I decided.
Well, different obligations. I mean, 20 years of serving your country. That's phenomenal. And obviously, we all respect you greatly for that. So you retired, came home.
Yeah.
And that's got to be a bit of adjustment as well. You're coming home. You know, many of us have seen the movies like Hurt Locker or otherwise, where I think they do a pretty good job of the psychology of one day you are boots on the ground in a battle zone, and the next day you're at the grocery store picking out cold cereal.
Yeah,
that's got to be a substantial psychological change.
Yeah, it's a challenge,
an adjustment.
Yeah, it's difficult, but not really. I mean, you just get back to breaking difficult things down into small, simple tasks, and you just
which is what you've been trained to do
one at a time until everything's done.
Well, and what's exciting, I think, about this story is not only have you had a very successful military career, but sometimes it's difficult to make that transition from the high echelons as a colonel in the Army in West Point to make that transition to civilian life.
Yeah,
but you've successfully done that. Obviously, a great family for one. But as a career, talk to us a little bit about your current position at Full Sail Ale.
Yeah, Full Sail Brewing Company is out of Hood River, Oregon. They have a CEO who I had worked with briefly a few years ago, trying to teach him or his organization how to enter the military retail market. He moved to Full Sail and thought we could do this again. And I jumped at the chance. I like beer. Full Sail Brewing is a great company. And I've been working, putting both Full Sail brand and Session brand beers into the military retail markets from the Army and Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Exchange Services, which is our grocery stores, alcohol packaged beverage stores, as well as all the...
Well, and you just recently went back to Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I was over in Hawaii, and I was able to sell our products into many of the stores over there. So,
but what a transition, really, though. I mean, it makes sense in the beer distribution, or any product for that matter, but specifically in the beer distribution, your ability, taking your experience in the military and having the opportunity to make contacts and probably oftentimes reach out to people that you haven't seen in quite a while.
Oh, yeah.
And make that connection to distribute your product in those areas.
Yeah. It's really fun. I can go back to bases I've been on before. I can reach out and touch some of the guys. In fact, I was in Virginia, and the commander of the old guard was the guy who's now in charge was one of the lieutenants of mine when I was in commanding Charlie Company, the old guard.
I think that's got to be a fascinating kind of full circle where you've spent so much time kind of in the trenches, so to speak, with these folks throughout a 20-year military career. Now it's circling back to these people that there's a lot of joint respect there.
Oh, yeah. The commitment of the guys in the Army and the Armed Forces in general is huge, and they deserve all of our respect. It's really something when you get to – I personally got to speak at a Veterans Day ceremony up at Priest Lake last week, and I've spoken at high schools here in Spokane a couple of times over the years. And when people are respecting veterans, it makes me really happy.
Absolutely. Well, we are extremely fortunate to have you sitting at this table and in Spokane. Someone like yourself with the background that you've had – it's amazing. We respect it, and we're excited to have you here. We'd love to have you come back and really drill down into almost what I would view as each of these topics that we've hit today. I think we could drill down and make chapters out of them. And almost, I think you got to promise that you'll sit down at some point and write a book. It'd be good for us and be good for your kids.
Yeah, maybe we do this enough, you can write the book.
Okay, well, maybe that's a deal. Rob, appreciate you being here on the show with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
Let's Talk Spokane is produced in Spokane, Washington by SpokaneTalksOnline.com, which is solely responsible for its content. Ask us a question, recommend a guest, and hear this program again online anytime at SpokaneTalksOnline.com. Thanks for listening.
Kids learn about money from their parents. They know whether you tend to save up for fun purchases or pull out the credit card when temptation strikes. Since they're learning from you, talk to your kids about using their money wisely. Start by admitting your own mistakes, talking about your family budget, and discussing the importance of sharing some of your money with causes that are important to you. There are general ways to help them become wise stewards of their own money. To learn more, go to stcumoney.org. If you need a sign, banner, or business cards for your business, who do you call?
Hi, this is Kent Adams.
And Tom MacArthur from Business Talks. Kent and I call Instant Sign Factory for our signs, banners, business cards, and more.
David Instant Sign Factory is our go-to guy for printing, and he always does excellent work for us.
Check them out online. They've got an all-new website, InstantSignFactory.com.
Tell them Kent and Tom from Business Talks sent you. Instant Sign Factory.
Hi, this is Kent Adams, co-host of Business Talks. I'd like to introduce you to a couple of friends, Lisa and Alan Gwaltney of Window World. I've known Lisa and Alan for a number of years and know them to be honest and caring folks. They take pride in their windows, sliding doors, and blinds. So when it comes to your home, call them direct at 509-456-5880. That's Window World of Spokane and Coeur d'Alene. And if you tell them Kent sent me, they'll give you 5% off a 5-window installation. Call them today at 456-5880.